Emily Anthes, Frankenstein's Cat. Emily, in your book, Frankenstein's Cat, you explore a lot of different ways that biotechnology is shaping the future of the animal world. But one of them I'm really interested in is cloning. Can you explain to me what the true definition of a clone is?
Well, there are a couple different technical definitions of a clone. Scientists talk about, for instance, cloning genes, which is just copying a gene in the lab. But when it's used in sort of public discussion, really it means one thing, and that's an animal or a creature that is an identical twin of another creature. It's essentially an exact genetic copy.
Even though, of course, it will have been born years after the original, so it's not a twin in the sense we think of a twin, right?
Exactly. It's as if you had human twins, but one was 8 and one was 15.
Makes you smile.
Yes.
You know, I don't think there's any way to talk about cloning now without talking about Dolly, who was a lamb born, 1996 or so?
That's right.
Quite a while ago, but it changed everything, didn't it?
It did, and Dolly was significant because she was the first clone of an adult mammal. Scientists had had some success previously cloning embryos from, say, frogs, but that's not as useful from a commercial standpoint. If you want to make a copy of a champion racehorse, for instance, or a beloved pet, you want to clone the adult. You don't want to clone an embryo because you don't know if the animal's going to be superlative or not. So Dolly's birth really opened up a whole new box of possibilities.
Dolly wasn't a twin of a living animal, was she?
She was not. She was a twin of a sheep that had died earlier, and scientists had preserved some of the dead sheep's cells. And so all they needed was the DNA from those cells to make Dolly.
Were they able to determine that she was an exact copy of the original lamb?
They were. She was a twin, a genetic clone.
So after she was born, things changed, right? I mean, they were able to do things they hadn't been able to do before?
Exactly. For one thing, it really launched the public discussion on cloning and brought that to the forefront. But it also presented all sorts of new opportunities for researchers, particularly agricultural researchers, who were very excited about this technology. There's big money in breeding great horses or great bulls, and cloning gives livestock owners and ranchers a new way to make exact genetic copies of their best performers. So there was a lot of interest in taking this technology and putting it to use in the livestock industry.
It's worth remembering, I guess, as you do in the beginning of the book, that we have spent hundreds of years trying to make another generation that is as good as the generation that came before. We've bred horses, we've bred dogs, bred cattle, I imagine. But this isn't the same as that. It's a huge leap forward, isn't it?
Yes, and it takes some of the guesswork out of selective breeding. Of course, as I also talk about, cloning has limitations, and there's no guarantee that just because the animal you start with was a champion racehorse that the clone will be as well. But at least you know you're starting with the exact same genetic material. And in theory, that gives you a better shot of replicating whatever success you had.
So after Dolly was born, what happened? Was there a huge leap with all sorts of other clones suddenly in the world?
It wasn't sudden, but what was sudden, I think, was all of a sudden, a whole bunch of other labs deciding, hey, we've got to try this. So rather than trying to make another sheep, what you saw was a lot of different researchers trying to clone other species. So slowly, we saw the first cloned cows, the first cloned deer, the first cloned cats. You had new species being cloned in this way.
One of the things that was kind of fascinating, and I guess, again, caught the public's eye, was something that happened at Texas A&M not long after Dolly's birth, I think. And that was the beginning of, what do you call it? It's not the pet revolution, but it's like that.
Yeah, pet cloning, essentially. And there was huge public interest in this. It's perhaps in retrospect not surprising, given how many people feel intensely attached to their pets. But the theory was that if you had a pet you loved and it went on to the great kennel in the sky, then wouldn't cloning be a wonderful way to get a new copy of it? And a wealthy pet owner actually approached the scientists at Texas A&M and said, I'm going to give you $3.7 million to try and make a clone of my dog. And it was originally just supposed to be sort of a research project funded by this millionaire. But of course, once the public got wind of it, the researchers were flooded with phone calls. Everyone wanted to know how they could get in on this, how they could sign their pets up for cloning.
This was what was called the Missiplicity Project?
That's right. The millionaire's dog, the dog that he wanted to clone, was a border collie mix named Missy. So there was the Missiplicity Project. One of the things I discovered is that animal cloners love wordplay and puns. So the field is full of them. The company they then founded to clone people's pets was called Genetic Savings and Clone, and so on.
Well, I guess the question that immediately follows is, was there another Missy? Did they successfully clone the border collie?
Yes, eventually. The original project was not a success. The Texas researchers did not manage to get a copy of Missy. As it turns out, for a variety of reasons, dog eggs are much harder to work with than cat eggs or cow eggs, and so they just didn't figure it out. Years later, some scientists in Korea eventually did clone Missy. They actually cloned three of her. So there are three Missy copies now running around out there.
It's important to note that this isn't really as simple as it sounds. It's not as though once Dolly was cloned, suddenly it was possible to do whatever you wanted. It doesn't always work. In fact, it doesn't often work, does it?
That's right. It's an incredibly inefficient process. So most scientists can now get a clone out of this whole process if they want to, but it takes a lot of failed attempts. You often have to create dozens or maybe even hundreds of cloned embryos, and only some of them will be viable in the womb, only some of them will make it to term, and maybe only one or two out of 100 embryos will actually be born and survive its birth.
It shows a lot of determination, but people clearly want this to happen.
Yes, and it also, of course, raises ethical questions about, are we willing to bear these costs of these stillbirths, all these cloned embryos, in order to get one special animal?
I guess one of the first answers is that there are, or seem to be, a lot of people who want to have, especially their pets, their cats, their dogs, the animals that have become close to them, they'd like to have them again.
That's right. And that's something that actually unsettled the researchers who were trying to do this dog and cat cloning, is they worried that pet owners, because of their devotion to their animals, might actually be taken advantage of. It's still an incredibly expensive procedure. There are two companies in South Korea where you can send your dog's cells to have them cloned, but it's $100,000 to do that. And scientists worry that people would think they were getting their same dog back. And that's just not the case. You're, of course, getting an identical twin. And because it's born so much later and potentially has a different upbringing, is going to be a different animal. It's not the same pet. And that's why the scientists sort of started repeating this mantra, which is cloning is reproduction. It's not resurrection.
And it's not, as a matter of fact, even necessarily going to look the same, is it? The first cat, I think, you mentioned who was cloned was a calico named Rainbow, who was genetically identical, but...
That's right. So it turns out that it's not just the genes themselves that matter. It's also how they're expressed. And so Rainbow was black, white, orange, but her clone was only black and white. She had no orange. And what turns out to have happened, the scientists think, is that the gene for orange fur was turned off in the clone. The expression of genes might be different in the clone than it is in the original animal, and that can yield visible differences in the way they look.
Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about the process that they used to create a clone of Rainbow, because I think it's important, if we're to understand why they don't turn out quite the same, to go back and look at all of the pieces in the process, I think.
Sure. So cloning is usually done with what's known as a somatic cell. So that means it's not a reproductive cell like a sperm or an egg. It's, you know, a skin cell or some other cell taken from the animal's body. So they took some somatic cells from Rainbow, and they wanted to use the DNA they contained to build a new cat. Of course, you can't just take a skin cell from a cat and put it in a cat uterus and expect an entirely new cat to grow. You have to get the DNA into the proper vehicle, which is an egg. So what cloning involves is the scientists harvested cat eggs from lots of female house cats. Then they sucked out the nucleus of each egg. And the nucleus, as you may remember from biology class, is what contains the genome or the DNA. So the scientists now had these empty eggs, and they could insert the DNA from Rainbow into the empty eggs. The eggs are then implanted in surrogate cat mothers and allowed to develop normally. And if everything goes well, she'll give birth to a cloned kitten.
Of course, you do have Rainbow's DNA, but you also have the egg, and the egg is not entirely uninvolved in the process, is it?
That's right. And even though most of the DNA, the vast, vast majority in an egg resides in the nucleus, there's a little tiny speck of DNA that's in the mitochondria, which are little cellular parts that live outside the nucleus. So a clone actually has the mitochondrial DNA of the egg donor, which is not the same as the genetic donor. So there is this tiny genetic discrepancy between a clone and its twin, and it's something that normally is sort of overlooked. Scientists think that because it's such a small amount of DNA, it doesn't matter much, but it does make it true that they're not technically quite exactly the same.
And then there is what you talked about, one of the genes, identical gene, but beyond that there are essentially switches that can be on or off. And even though you have the same DNA, it may say different things.
Exactly. And particularly because you're taking what I talked about, one of these somatic cells in the body. So different cells in different parts of the body have their genetic switches essentially on different settings. That's what makes a heart cell different than a skin cell, different than a blood cell. So if you take one of these, what's called differentiated cells, and put them in an egg, it's going to have its settings already set to something specific, and it might not be what an egg normally has its settings on. So that can lead to differences in how genes are expressed in the end resulting animal.
And this is how, when you met Rainbow's clone, you talk about wordplay, they called Rainbow's clone CC, which was short for what, carbon copy?
Carbon copy. Also, sometimes people say copycat. Either one works.
So when you met CC, you had seen pictures, I guess, of Rainbow. Had you ever met
exactly.
Rainbow?
No, I don't think Rainbow was still alive by the time I got onto the scene, unfortunately.
But when you
but
saw
CC. But I had seen
CC.
Pictures of, yes, I saw pictures of Rainbow, and she was classic calico, black, white, gray, orange. And then I met CC, and she was very cute, but there was no orange anywhere on her body. I never would have guessed that she was a clone.
If you'd taken black and white pictures of the two, maybe, but with the
perhaps.
Color, not.
Yes.
So that's what they call, X inactivation?
Right. So that's the specific process they think was responsible for this discrepancy. Female cats have two X chromosomes, just like humans do, and in any particular cell, one X chromosome is turned off. As it happens, the orange gene is carried on one X chromosome and the black gene is on the other one. So what scientists think happened is what scientists think happened is the cell they took from Rainbow had the X chromosome with the orange gene turned off. And so as a result, that gene is turned off in all of CC's cells.
We tend to think scientists can do anything. Are we yet at the point where they could go in, look at it, and say, oops, we need to flip that switch?
That's a good question. I think that is beyond our capabilities right now, particularly once you have an adult animal like CC, you could never get into every single cell. It may be possible in the future to, if you catch it when it's still an embryo, a cloned embryo, perhaps you could change the genetic settings there or fiddle with them to turn that chromosome on.
When Rainbow was cloned and CC was born, did any of the people involved with Rainbow look at CC? Did it seem to be the same cat?
It did. They were surprised that she didn't match Rainbow. They hadn't anticipated this phenomenon of X inactivation. But they did do genetic tests and confirmed that she was indeed a clone of Rainbow, even though she might not have looked like it.
Earlier, we were talking about the Border Collie Missy, and you said three clones were eventually made of Missy. Did any of them go to Missy's owner?
They did. They all did, in fact. And Missy's owner reported that they were just like Missy. They looked the same. They had the same quirks. It's a little hard to know if that would stand up to scrutiny, but the owners are reportedly very happy.
Well, I'm curious because, of course, a successful cloning, for it to be commercially viable, has to result in the owner being happy with the next generation. And I gather that though people are still in love with the idea of cloning their pets, it hasn't become the huge industry that, that some anyway, hoped it would be.
Excuse me. No, it has not become a huge industry despite the public interest. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. Most of all, right now, it's still very expensive. As I mentioned, six figures. And most pet owners, no matter how devoted they might be to their animal, are not prepared to pay that. It's also still an experimental technology. The company that was offering pet cloning in the U.S. eventually shut down. It said in part because it was getting inconsistent results and because it's this inefficient process that requires lots of dogs to get one cloned pet dog out. So I think if the price drops significantly and the procedure becomes more reliable and more efficient, it certainly could take off. I'm not sure it will ever be a mainstream method of reproduction for pets.
Well, and there are, as you've mentioned, ethical issues involved. And a lot of people are concerned about the number of eggs it takes to create one successful clone, the number of surgeries that need to be done on healthy living animals in order for one next generation dog or cat or mouse, for that matter, to be successfully found. The ethics of it are not as simple as it may sound.
Exactly. And, of course, there are still welfare concerns with the clones themselves. It's a little hard to know exactly how the clones are affected in the long term, partly because there have not been a ton of clones. But the FDA did review data on cattle clones and a few other species and found that the clones themselves are more likely to suffer from various defects and diseases early in life. It does seem that if you can usher these clones safely through the first 6 months to a year of their life, they tend to develop into healthy adults. But there's a lot of loss along the way.
Of course, there are personality issues, too. You mentioned one case of a bull that was owned by a rodeo clown who wanted the same mild-mannered bull. It's not what he got when he got the clone, was it?
No, he had cloned his pet bull, Chance, who was lovely because he was so gentle. And Second Chance, as of course they named the clone, was not anything like Chance. He attacked his owner several times, landing him in the hospital. And so it just goes to show you that if you can get a clone that doesn't even look like its twin, you can certainly get one that doesn't act like its twin. Personality is a complex trait, and it's not just dictated by a couple of genes.
Are there laws in place either to oversee cloning or to protect animals used in cloning?
Not specifically related to cloning. There are a variety of animal welfare laws in the U.S. that govern the kinds of things researchers can and can't do, the kind of homes they have to provide for animals, how they can control pain and suffering, but it doesn't deal with cloning specifically.
So how popular is pet cloning these days? I know you've said that that the cost interferes with a lot of people, but I guess the idea still thrives.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe there are only a handful of Americans, at least, who have gotten their pets cloned. But you can see interest in the idea because there are these companies that seem to be doing well, and their business model is based on storing your pet's DNA for a time in the future when cloning might become less expensive or more reliable. So there are people having their pet cells frozen and put in liquid nitrogen storage and hoping that one day they will be able to get a clone.
This is what you call a frozen zoo. You actually went to see one, didn't you?
I did. That was a little bit different. It's not for pet cloning. Most of the frozen zoos that have been established are holding samples of wild creatures. So the idea is that perhaps conservationists might be able to clone species that are endangered or possibly even species that one day go extinct. But the idea is the same, that you suspend their cells and their samples in liquid nitrogen, and someday if you want to clone them, you can thaw them out and they're ready to use.
It is a whole different thing, isn't it? This is unlike the need to save your grandmother's favorite cat. The idea of saving endangered species is maybe ethically less challenging?
I think so. It's still, I should emphasize, experimental, and it's still not a silver bullet. Cloning alone isn't going to save endangered species, but I think it could be useful in limited ways. And there's a little bit more of a case you can make that maybe this experimentation and these welfare costs might be worth it if it could help save species.
How does it work? Do you take the last existing specimen of a species and hope you can save the DNA for the day when there will be better technology to revive them?
Well, that's sort of a last-ditch effort. That is one possibility, and there are some frozen zoos that now have samples from species that have gone extinct recently, and there's been talk about bringing them back. I think most scientists are trying to store DNA before it gets to that point or it gets that bad. For instance, one of the big problems with endangered species is that there's a lack of genetic diversity, not just that there are too few animals. So the idea is if you can take enough cell samples from different, say, wild tigers out in the world, if one day the tigers go through a population crisis and they lose some important genes, perhaps you could clone those genes back into the population by reviving these cells you've stored.
I didn't realize either until you, in the book, raised the example of the cheetah, I believe, that they one of the reasons that they're endangered is that many of the genetic traits in the cheetah have been kind of bred out of existence, so that what's left isn't as diverse as it needs to be for the species to thrive.
Exactly. The cheetahs went through what's known as a population bottleneck, where their numbers dropped precipitously, and there were only a few surviving genetic lineages. And as they rebuilt their population over the years, of course, that meant there was lots of inbreeding and this drastic reduction in genetic diversity. And that's a problem partly because inbreeding causes its own welfare concerns, but also because when you have a homogenous population, they're more likely to all be suddenly wiped out by a disease or a disaster. You don't have variations that help keep a population robust.
One of the other things that is an issue with endangered species is habitat. Is there a suggestion that if enough of them were brought back, they might actually adapt to different habitats or change existing habitats to more resemble the habitat that was?
I don't think there's many people saying that we'd like to bring these animals back and put them in different habitats, but habitat quality is a major concern because, of course, you can clone a million cheetahs, but if you have nowhere to put them, it doesn't do them much good. Likewise, it doesn't do them much good if you don't solve whatever problems caused them to go extinct or become endangered in the first place, if you don't solve the poaching problem or the habitat destruction problem. So preserving and even increasing habitats for wild animals is a necessary part of cloning. Cloning can only work if we have these safe habitats for the creatures.
There's also some suggestion you talk about or write about, though, that with the gray wolf, for instance, bringing it back did in fact change many parts of the environment and they lived in and reversed some habitat decline.
That's right. So there are suggestions and proposals for what is commonly being called rewilding. And that's where we take animals that have maybe gone extinct or disappeared from a particular area and we put them back. And some scientists have made a convincing case that by having the right species in a habitat, you can change the habitat. You can help it evolve or return to a more productive area. So in the case of these gray wolves, for instance, they weren't brought back through cloning. They were merely reintroduced to Yellowstone. But they helped thin out the herds of elk, which had exploded after the wolves had disappeared. And when the elk populations were thinned out a bit, the vegetation did better. And when the vegetation did better, beavers came back and songbirds came back. So it is true that if you restore the right species to an area, it can have these ripple effects that are good for an entire ecosystem.
And you can take this to an extreme. Aren't there some who are proposing to bring back the mammoth or some other beasts that are no longer around? We have some DNA to suggest that we might be able to do that. There was a case in Russia, in Siberia, I think you were talking about. They were sort of hoping that they could go back to the days when there was vegetation there.
Exactly. There's a park being built called Pleistocene Park in Siberia, and it's sort of a tundra right now, some shrubs, some moss, not a lot of vegetation. And one scientist thinks that mammoths and other big grazing herbivores could help restore this tundra to a verdant grassland, more like what it used to be. And so he's offered up his Pleistocene Park to scientists saying, if you ever bring the mammoth back, I've got a place for them.
Would it work, do you think? Is there any suggestion that he's right?
The rewilding may work. The return to grasslands may work. The much bigger challenge is going to be cloning the mammoth. Scientists have found some decently well-preserved carcasses buried under permafrost, but the DNA is still extremely degraded, and that's the main challenge, cloning the mammoth, not restoring the ecosystem, I think.
So after all of the research you've done and all of the researchers you've talked to, what's your take on cloning pets and cloning endangered species?
I think cloning is clearly not ready for prime time. I don't think we're ready for a lot of commercial outfits to clone pets. I don't think we're ready to clone 1,000 cheetahs and put them in the wild. But I do think it has promise. And so I think if researchers can figure out how to get clones with less collateral damage along the way, with fewer animals undergoing surgeries, with fewer birth defects, I think it has real potential. I just think we're not there yet.
The end of the book, you write about looking into your crystal ball of biotechnology. Is that what you see when you gaze into it?
An increase in cloning?
Yeah.
I do think it will become more common. It has become more common, particularly in the livestock industry. And I think we could see it being used for interesting applications, for instance, cloning animals that are resistant to various diseases, which would be a great breakthrough, I think. There's been some work on that already. And I think we'll see more of those things start to happen. Whether it ever becomes a totally mainstream method of animal reproduction, I'm not sure, but I'm certain we'll see more of it.
And for all of those oddities we also read about, are they going to increase? Are we going to have luminescent cats, for instance? Robotic mice?
I think they will certainly increase. The big question with a lot of these advances is whether there's a societal demand for them and whether society will accept them. I think the science will continue to move forward. Whether people want to buy a glow-in-the-dark cat for their homes is an entirely different question, but we'll be seeing more of them in the labs.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Scary a little bit, but, or maybe I mean disturbing rather than scary. It's odd to think about constructing living beings.
It is, and it's simultaneously astonishing. I find myself amazed by what scientists can do, but it's also unsettling for many of the same reasons.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.